we do end up making any mistakes, we hope that it's on days like today, field days, simulation days, and not, you know, in another week when we become available for fires.
Firefighters run simulations to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, not all Anchorage parents are thrilled about switching elementary and high school start times.
I have major concerns because my kids aren't early risers, and many of the families that I work with, none of their kids are early risers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside Alaska. And it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 1-800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
An Alaska state trooper is charged with attempted sexual abuse of a minor after allegedly trying to meet a 16-year-old girl at an Anchorage hotel. That's according to the felony charges filed against Soldotna-based trooper Vance Peronto. The charges say the 57-year-old trooper met the girl when he stopped her car April 8th for driving with her headlights off on the Kenai Spur Highway. Peronto didn't give her a ticket, but the charges say the next morning the officer sent the girl a friend request on Facebook, and the two began exchanging explicit messages on social media. According to the charges, he offered to be her personal trooper and requested photos and videos of her, which she sent. The girl's father reported him to the troopers on Thursday. Peronto allegedly had plans to meet the girl at an Anchorage hotel on Sunday, but when he arrived, he was met by other troopers and officers with the Anchorage Police Department. Peronto is a 16-year veteran of the Alaska State Troopers. At one point, according to the charge against him, he broke off communications with the girl, saying it was not worth losing his career and going to jail for 10 to 20 years. But then he allegedly wrote her again and asked her to come to his house to watch a movie. The law Peronto is accused of violating makes it illegal for a person in a position of authority to attempt to have sex with someone who is 16 or 17. An Anchorage judge heard arguments today in a lawsuit brought by 16 young Alaskans who are suing the state over climate change. The plaintiffs argue the state of Alaska is violating their constitutional rights by failing to limit greenhouse gas emissions, and they're asking the courts to intervene. But the state says climate change policies are for the legislature and the executive branch to decide, not the courts. Alaska's Energy Desk reporter Rachel Waldholz listened to the arguments today and is at the courthouse in downtown Anchorage. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori.
So what's the big issue in this case? Break it down for us.
Yeah, well, as you said, the lawsuit was brought by young Alaskans from across the state, and they say they're already seeing the impacts of climate change firsthand, you know, whether it's coastal erosion or the loss of sea ice or warmer ocean waters. And so they say the state is violating their constitutional rights by continuing to encourage activities that emit greenhouse gases, like oil and gas development, even though the state knows that those activities will lead to climate change. So the big issue before the court today was just whether the courts can compel the state to take action on climate change. So the state says no. It's asking the court to dismiss the case entirely. It says that climate policy is something that the political branches, the executive branch and the state legislature, have to decide. But the plaintiffs argue that the state has made its climate change policy clear by continuing to encourage oil and gas development and other activities that that emit greenhouse gases. And since the state has made that policy clear, the courts can intervene. And so the big question is whether this case can go forward. And so the judge will rule on whether to dismiss it or allow it to go forward.
And why does this matter?
Yeah, I mean, if the case goes forward, I mean, plaintiffs are asking for the courts to establish a pretty sweeping climate policy. They're asking the courts to intervene and say that the state of Alaska has to cut greenhouse gas emissions and has to create a climate policy, which we do not have. So that would be a big deal. That said, a similar case was brought a couple of years ago by young plaintiffs, including the plaintiff Nelson Canuck. And that was dismissed by the Alaska Supreme Court in 2014, which said that it was not the court's place to order that kind of policy that has to happen, you know, through the executive branch and through the legislature.
I'm glad that you mentioned that. The plaintiffs clearly think they have a chance, but how is this case different from the one that was dismissed in 2014?
Right. And that was really what the argument was about today. So basically, the state says it's not different. It's the same case. And so the court should dismiss it because the Alaska Supreme Court has already ruled. But the plaintiffs said that, you know, in the years since that ruling, the state of Alaska has had the chance to make climate policy. And by continuing to encourage oil and gas extraction and by failing to enact any climate policy, it has, in effect, made its policy clear. And since that policy is not to act on climate change, the state is, you know, actively violating the plaintiff's rights.
So, Rachel, what was the tone today? Did you get any sense of how the judge might rule?
Of course, it's impossible to say. I will say the judge seemed skeptical of some of the young Alaskans' attorneys' arguments, definitely asked a lot more questions of that side. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, asked pretty skeptical questions of both sides, so it's hard to tell. And we're not expecting a ruling immediately. There will be a written ruling sometime, probably in the next 6 months.
All right. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Lori.
That was Rachel Waldholtz with Alaska's Energy Desk reporting from Alaska Superior Court in downtown Anchorage. Alaska owes public workers more than $6 billion more in pensions than it has in assets. The legislature has passed a bill to lower the amount of bonds the state could sell to reduce this unfunded pension liability. Senator Anna McKinnon is an Eagle River Republican. She says the bill is a compromise for senators and House members.
There are some in both bodies that thought we should eliminate all possibility of borrowing.
Current state law allows Governor Bill Walker's administration to sell up to $5 billion in bonds, but the legislature needs to appropriate that money. The bill would reduce that amount to $1.5 billion, but it signals that at least some lawmakers would support an appropriation in the future. The bonds would essentially be low-interest debt. The state could use that money to invest. If interest returns were higher than the bond's rate, the state would save money. The House passed the bill on Saturday, and the Senate agreed to changes the House made today. It's the start of wildland fire season in Alaska, and firefighters are testing their proficiency at operating equipment as well as their mental and physical fortitude. At the same time, fire officials are watching out for the hot, dry, and windy weather that elevates fire danger. They say it's difficult to know what to expect this fire season, but as Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, the firefighters are doing everything they can to be ready.
The Pioneer Peak Hotshots and Gannett Glacier Fire Crew are among the best trained in the state, but even they have mandatory training every year. A line of about a dozen firefighters in yellow shirts and hard hats is following their chainsaw-wielding teammates up a hill, cutting a swath through the forest alongside an imaginary fire. Pioneer Peak Crew Superintendent Chris Baumgartner explains.
So right off the edge of it, right in front of it, we're going to remove those fuels and with the chainsaws and then dig a trail up, and the fire burns to the edge of the fire line, that dirt, and dirt doesn't burn. And ideally, that holds your fire.
This is the kind of boots-on-the-ground work it takes to contain potentially massive fires. The goal is to protect people and homes, but it can be dangerous. Baumgartner says that's where the training comes in.
Yeah, in these field days, they don't know what's coming. And so I'm trying to test them, you know, and make sure everything that we've taught them in the last 2 weeks, you know, is setting in. And so if we do end up making any mistakes, we hope that it's on days like today, field days, simulation days, and not, you know, in another week when we become available for fires.
The Gannett Glacier crew is nearby, marching through a grassy field. They have their own imaginary fire to fight. In the real world, there would be a more obvious towering column of smoke, but here it's just marked with pink flagging. They stand in a circle and get a quick briefing. Some take the opportunity to take a swig of water from their canteens. Then the men and one woman form a single file line, checking to make sure they're all moving together.
Moving, 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 moving,
moving,
moving.
There's other call and response communication between the crew members, as well as a slew of acronyms for remembering safety procedures. Then there are the sayings, which are repeated like mantras.
So we say slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
This is Brian Quimby, the Gannett Glacier crew superintendent.
When we're on fires, there's sometimes a tendency, especially when, you know, communities are threatened or things like that, for these guys to go really hard. But the problem that we're worried about is there's a lot of heat-related injuries, heat stroke, heat illness, and we don't want people ever to get to that point because ultimately, no house, no tree is worth one of these guys' lives.
There's the methodology and tactical training, then there's physical ability and equipment training for some other wildland firefighters. In one test, they have to steer a truck through a timed course without hitting too many of the orange cones, maybe one or two. It's carrying thousands of pounds of water, and by the way, half of the course has to be done in reverse. Each firefighter also has to prove they can hike several miles loaded down with a weighted backpack. The pack test left firefighter Wedge Warford out of breath, but he was pleased with his performance and says it's all about keeping a steady pace.
A good day for a walk. Not too hot. More of a psychological tough. You know, you can really psych yourself out.
Forestry officials say it's too early to know much about what to expect later this fire season. They say the fact that most of Alaska had above average snowfall this past winter is generally a good thing, because it keeps grass and other fuels on the ground moist for longer into the summer. But Fire Management Officer Norm McDonald says he and his colleagues are on alert for hot, dry, and windy weather. Fire danger can change quickly, and McDonald says forecasting more than a couple weeks out is pretty difficult.
We're getting better at it. I think right now they're predicting what they call a normal or average summer. You know, that could be a million acres, and if the million acres are in a populated area, that, you know, could be devastating.
This time of year, McDonald says he's concerned about dry grass and human-caused fires. Forestry officials also say they hope more people take the time to do work around their homes to create what's called defensible space, in case a wildfire encroaches. And, as always, they want to remind Alaskans to get burn permits from their local fire departments before burning brush or other debris. Still, it's inevitable that human or lightning-caused fires will occur. So for now, McDonald and the firefighters continue to, as they say, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. In Palmer, I'm Casey Grove.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, friendly competition and sibling rivalry come out at this year's Native Youth Olympics.
I'm able to tell my sister that I beat her record because I've been working hard to reach that 58 inches that she's been trying to reach.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
The Anchorage School District is considering a huge change. The district is looking at implementing new school start times, with elementary schools starting earlier and high schools later. The district held a series of open house events recently to educate the community and hear feedback. Alaska Public Media's Victoria Peterson attended an open house and has this story.
At the Anchorage School District's first open house for school start times, poster boards are set up on tables inside Lake Hood Elementary. Parents, teachers, and community members are gathered around the tables, talking with school district personnel about the potential start time changes. Pamela Whitwer, a parent and a teacher at Gladyswood Elementary School, says she's worried about the potential change.
I have major concerns because my kids aren't early risers, and many of the families that I work with, none of their kids are early risers, so these aren't kids that are up at 6 a.m., and so they struggle to get to school at 9, as it is.
Whitwer isn't alone. Nearly every parent and teacher I talked to at the open house expresses similar concerns. The school district is proposing the change in an effort to improve attendance, reduce tardiness, and increase graduation rates. The school district cites national research that suggests middle schoolers and high schoolers do better with later start times, and younger students benefit from starting earlier. Anchorage School District Superintendent Dina Bishop says the open houses are an opportunity to gather input about the new start times.
This change isn't as simple as just change a start time and everybody will be happy. The entire community is nearly affected, so we wanted to be sure that we data sourced it.
Bishop says she recognizes that switching elementary schools to an earlier start time will not be easy, and she understands the change would ripple throughout the community. Child care is a big issue, making sure daycare providers are able to adjust their schedules to match the school district. Bishop says the district would hope to tackle that issue through partnerships with local nonprofits.
We would never want a parent to be, stress of just having a family and running a family and getting to work on time and getting your kid to school and back and forth and, getting food on a table. All those things are real life worries and actions for our families. So we wouldn't want the school to put extra stress on families.
The school district is proposing four scenarios, one of which is no change to the schedule at all. The other scenarios have high schoolers starting at 8:30 a.m. or after, and the elementary students starting no later than 7:45 in the morning. Last year, a student created an online petition that urged the school district to study later school start times for high schoolers. The petition gathered thousands of signatures and pushed the school district to hire Western demographics to study the issue. Shannon Bingham is leading the research team. He says it's clear high schoolers benefit from later start times, but the research isn't as conclusive on elementary kids starting earlier.
So as far as the quantity of research that's out there, there's significantly less. And so some of the minority opinions and some of the more recent research is saying earlier start times are not necessarily good for elementary school children either.
But Bingham says the research they conducted on elementary students showed that younger children who had to wake up earlier weren't negatively impacted. Jose Lopez attended the Lake Hood open house with his wife and three children. He thinks it would be hard for elementary kids to make the switch.
I have three kids that attended school early, and I kind of have a hard time making the younger kids start up earlier than the older kids.
The Anchorage School District says the comments received so far have been mixed. Parents of middle and high school students tend to be in favor of the change, while parents of elementary students are not. The Anchorage School Board will make a decision later this year, and any changes will be implemented in the 2019-2020 school year. From Anchorage, I'm Victoria Peterson.
The Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center is preparing for a future that includes more tourists and a melting attraction. On Thursday, more than 50 people attended an open house to catch a glimpse of the new concepts. That includes expanding some of the national forest trails and creating a shuttle system to reduce traffic. But some of the biggest proposed changes could help people get closer to the retreating ice. John Neary, the Visitor Center director, says his agency is trying to adapt.
The glacier we know is going to disappear within that 20-year time frame. We're pretty sure of that. So given that most people are coming here to see a view of the glacier, we're going to chase the ice up the valley.
So he says small commercial boats, possibly electric, could be the solution to getting up close. The boats could take you to some kind of mobile visitor center near the old ice caves, which would move with the glacier over time. A wolf killed a dog this morning along the Brotherhood Bridge Trail. It's the second time a wolf has killed a dog in Juneau in 6 months. Ryan Scott is a wildlife supervisor for Southeast Alaska for the Department of Fish and Game, one of the agencies that responded to the attack. Scott declined to name the dog owner, but says they lost sight of the dog along the tree line. The owner eventually found the dog dead next to a deer carcass just off the trail. Officials were called around 8:45 a.m. The site was about 300 yards from the trailhead on Glacier Highway. Scott's theory is the wolf killed the deer and was protecting its kill. Both normal behaviors.
You know, there was already a kill site there, and, you know, potentially the dog wandered into it. And, you know, the wolf didn't take the dog. It took the deer that was already dead.
He says the dog was off leash and that the owner thinks they spotted the wolf leaving with a piece of the deer. Scott says officials removed the remains of the deer to reduce the chance of more trailside wildlife encounters. Scott says he doesn't think there's any public safety or pet safety issue out of the ordinary on Brotherhood Bridge Trail. He says just stay vigilant.
To keep an eye on your pets. I mean, these are such random things that happen. But it's just keeping an eye on what's going on and paying attention to our surroundings.
In an encounter, he advises not running, making a lot of noise, and standing your ground. The last negative wolf encounter Scott was aware of was in November on the Lemon Creek Trail. when a chihuahua was killed.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Anchorage Assembly doesn't think the city has decent child care options. On Friday, members convened a work session to hear about high costs and limited availability, a first step in learning about the issue as they prepare potential policy proposals. Assembly members heard the message from daycare professionals that quality child care in Anchorage is not currently financially feasible. Care for a single infant costs more than $1,000 on average, and households spend nearly double a share of their income on child care, as is recommended by federal guidelines. Assembly Chair Forrest Dunbar says the issue came on his radar during a short-lived proposal he introduced related to subsidizing daycare for elected members. In the process, constituents told him that even middle-class families with two working parents struggle to pay for child care.
It's more expensive than a mortgage, more expensive than health care in some cases. It's their single largest expense.
Dunbar says the goal of upcoming work sessions on the topic is to better understand municipal policies that can affect child care costs and availability. That might include adjustments to zoning requirements or other code changes. He expects a potential ordinance could come during the summer. The Alaska Sea Life Center's family of octopuses is growing. A giant Pacific octopus named Gilligan laid thousands of eggs about a year ago. Less than 100 hatched this month. Aquarium curator Richard Hawking expects the remaining eggs to hatch by the end of May. Once the eggs hatch, staff transport them to a separate tank where they can feed on zooplankton. Young giant Pacific octopuses are about a quarter inch long and have fully developed eyes. An adult is between 9 and 16 feet long, but the odds the hatchlings will make it to adulthood are slim. The survival rate of hatchlings is 1% in the wild, and there is only one documented case of a giant Pacific octopus successfully being reared in an aquarium. The Alaska Sea Life Center has attempted to raise hatchlings twice before. Both attempts were unsuccessful. The center says the babies are extremely delicate and have complex nutritional needs. Still, the staff is hopeful this time will be different. Visitors can see Gilligan and her hatchlings in the aquarium's Octopus Grotto exhibit. The Native Youth Olympics is much more than an athletic competition. It's an expression of Arctic culture, with games based on the skills required to survive on land and ice. KYUK's Johanna Urich looks at the role of family and joy in the accomplishments of a couple of this year's outstanding athletes.
So close.
The one-arm reach is considered by many to be one of the toughest games in the Native Youth Olympics, and this year it was dominated by girls from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
She actually hit the ball in that last one, just didn't maintain her balance after the reach.
That's Bethel coach Tommy Bayayak. In the one-arm reach, balance is crucial. A ball made of sealskin is suspended above the athlete, who is perched on one hand. A judge lies on the floor checking to make sure that no other part of the body but the hand touches the floor while the athlete reaches for the ball overhead. Jo Beth Stewart of Bethel came in third, reaching 56 inches. Chantal Snyder from Quiquilingok watched, along with her coach, who is her upa, that's grandfather in Yupik. Chantal and her upa discussed the competition in Yuktung. Chantal has an advantage. The one-hand reach is a family tradition.
It's in my genes, I think. It's been passing down from my sister to me. My little sister, Delores, she's 7 years old, and she's already inspired by how one arm is to us.
Long reaches can throw athletes off balance. To get more height, some balance on their knuckles instead of their hand. Chantal, however, uses a unique approach. She harnesses the strength of her thumb and fingers to push higher, gaining a few extra inches while maintaining a more stable platform to hold her legs off the floor while she reaches.
It looks like it's a flat hand, but I raise it up on my thumb for a higher height. I'm not using my palm to balance.
No one taught her this technique.
My sister used to do the knuckle, but I taught myself to use my thumb and my other fingers.
And it works.
And taking the gold medal all the way back to the Lower Kuskokwim School District, reaching 58 inches, Chantel Snyder.
I'm able to tell my sister that I beat her record because I've been working hard to reach that 58 inches that she's been trying to reach ever since she was in high school. And I have to tell her I tried reaching 59.
Chantel Snyder has a 4.0 grade average. She also understands the need to support others. When her friend Caitlin Paul was struggling in the 2-foot high kick, Snyder massaged her arms to get her to relax before facing a tough opponent. It was not enough. Caitlin Paul came in second behind the indomitable Alexandria Ivanov from the Bering Strait School District. Allie is an outstanding athlete, taking 3 first place ribbons in the scissors broad jump, the 1-foot and 2-foot high kick. She came in second in the kneel jump. Nick Hansen, better known as the Eskimo Ninja on the Ninja Warrior television show, was her coach.
You're so high. Yeah, but you're jumping so high, go straight instead. Okay. Jump straight up instead, okay?
Not only did Ivanov win the 2-foot high kick, she kept going, looking for a personal best by using Hansen's suggestion to pull her arms down when she jumped.
Yeah, it's gonna help get my hips above, basically get my hips above my body so I don't fold over in half and then stop right where I'm level.
Hansen also told her to kick with joy. It worked.
75 inches. Yeah, feels good.
The 2-foot high kick at 6'5" was way above her head. Allie Ivanov also took a first place Saturday in the 1-foot high kick, leaving with another personal best at 91 inches. I'm Johanna Urich.
Finally tonight, a correction. The final environmental impact statement for the proposed Donlin Gold project released on Friday does not have a 30-day public comment period as we previously reported. In fact, there is no public comment period for the entire document. Instead, the public has 30 days to comment on a section of it. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Palmer, Rachel Waldholtz, Victoria Peterson, Zachariah Hughes, and Johanna Urich in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman, Jeremy Shea, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Renee Gross in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday, you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.